Coming up on The Green from Delaware Public Media. The first state won a legal battle in federal court last week over a new campaign finance disclosure law.
These laws don't prevent anybody from speaking, and they don't prevent anybody from contributing money. They merely say it's really important to add to the marketplace information about who's paying for this.
Widener Delaware Law School Dean Rod Smola rejoins us this week to analyze the decision and its impact. In the 70s and 80s, Rehoboth Beach was a summer getaway for gay men, one of the few places at the time these men say they could truly be themselves.
We would drive into town, and all you wanted to do was unload the car, have a beer, and just say, thank God I'm here.
In part one of a two-part History Matters, we examine the gay community's history in Rehoboth Beach and that history's impact on LGBT rights in the state. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. We also look at what's behind the declining moth population in Delaware in our latest installment of I See Change. The Green, where Delaware explores its common ground, is next. But first, the latest news from NPR. Welcome to this week's edition of The Green. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. Last week, Delaware won a key legal battle in the state's effort to bolster its campaign finance laws. The Federal Third Circuit Court of Appeals in Philadelphia overruled a Delaware District Court judge in a case involving the Delaware Elections Disclosure Act. The law was passed in 2012 and signed by Governor Jack Markell, then enacted in 2013. The law requires third-party groups and individuals to disclose to the state elections commissioner donors who give $100 or more if the group or individual spend more than $500 on advertisements or other communications that refer to a candidate in an upcoming election. A conservative advocacy group, Delaware Strong Families, had an issue with the Delaware Elections Disclosure Act regarding its publication of a voter's guide. They said the law was overly broad and created burdensome regulations and would chill the group's right to free speech. In 2014, Delaware District Court Judge Sue Robinson agreed with Delaware Strong Families' argument and barred the state from enforcing the law until the group's lawsuit made its way through the courts. The Third Circuit Court overruled Robinson last week, allowing Delaware to start enforcing the Delaware Elections Disclosure Act. This week, I sat down with new Widener University Delaware Law Dean Rod Smola to get his analysis of this decision.
What was the basis for the Third Court's reversal of the lower court ruling on the Delaware Elections Disclosure Act?
The Disclosure Act requires people who contribute to certain kinds of political advertising to accept that if their contributions exceed a certain amount, and it's a relatively low amount, their names will be disclosed as people that contributed to the political advertising. And so in this case, there were two triggers. If a group conducts advertising relating to an election and they spend more than $500, which is not much money, then they must disclose anyone that contributed to that advertising if that contribution is over $100. So those are relatively low limits. And the question was, do those limits violate the First Amendment? The group that was engaged in the advertising said yes, because there's a right to contribute money anonymously. And these are very low thresholds. Essentially, almost anybody that would contribute would be covered by it if it was over $100. And what the Third Circuit Court of Appeals ruled was, no, we think it's okay. And the reason we think it's okay is that there are similar rules in place at the national level that have been upheld, and there are similar rules in place in many, many states across the country that have been upheld. This notion that once you contribute over a certain amount, you don't have the right to keep your contribution secret. Rather, the public has a very strong interest in knowing who is contributing to these ads, has been accepted by the U.S. Supreme Court and courts around the country. And so the Court of Appeals said, what we're really fussing over is how much money do you have to give before you forfeit your rights? And the Delaware law was unusual in that it wasn't much. At the federal level, for example, a group has to spend at least $10,000 in advertising, and the individual contribution has to be $1,000 or more. That's pretty big money for most folks. Sure. So you compare that to $500 and a minimum of $100. And the interesting thing is the Third Circuit Court of Appeals said, but you know, it's Delaware. It's a very small state. people don't spend as much on politics here. Campaigns are not as expensive as they are in other places. You can get fairly significant advertising relatively cheaply here. There's no statewide television stations. Most of the television programming comes in from Pennsylvania, New Jersey, and so on for folks here. And so the Court of Appeals said, once you adjust for scale, once you adjust for size, it's about right. It's good enough. And the court on that basis said, we don't find these limits too low, and we uphold these disclosure requirements.
The group, Delaware Strong Families, also seem to be concerned about the law being a bit too broad, particularly in the area of previously under Delaware law, if you were advocating for a candidate or against the candidate, you would have to disclose under this law. Now, if you're just referring to a candidate, did the Third Circuit at all look at that particular part of the issue?
The court looked at a distinction that has been recognized in free speech law, distinguishing between political speech that is directly concerned with a particular candidate, trying to elect or defeat a particular candidate, and speech that's called issue advocacy, in which it's not so much about a candidate but about an issue, immigration or abortion or whatever it might be. And what the court said is, we don't think that the law's constitutionality turns on that distinction. And so even though the Delaware law reaches both issue advertising and the more candidate-focused advertising, the court said, we think the right of the public to know who's paying for the advertising trumps the right of anonymity of the people that are contributing.
Governor Markell had argued that this law closes a loophole in disclosure, and the law makes information about who's spending money on elections better and more timely in the way it gets to voters. Does the Third Circuit's decision effectively side with that point of view?
I think it does side with the point of view of those that were responsible for passing this law, which is that we're not dealing with a very powerful First Amendment right here, because these laws don't prevent anybody from speaking and they don't prevent anybody from contributing money. They merely say it's really important to add to the marketplace information about who's paying for this stuff, and that voters are well informed and the elections tend to be fairer if people know who's contributing the money. And in that sense, the Third Circuit definitely bought into that point of view.
Obviously, this law and others like it have come in response to Citizens United, essentially, I guess, in some way saying, look, if there's going to be all this money in elections, we at least want people to see where it's coming from. Does this ruling have any implications beyond the specific case and Delaware in these efforts to maybe chip away at Citizens United?
Well, I don't think it is a chipping away of Citizens United, because one of the few places where the justices tended to agree with each other in Citizens United, and one of the few areas of this highly controversial area of law in which the liberals and the conservatives on the court have tended to be on the same side, involves disclosure. So for many of the reasons we've already talked about, you know, there's a tremendous debate about how much money should be allowed in politics. There's a tremendous debate about whether there should or shouldn't be these limits. But there's much less debate about the rules that require letting folks know who's contributing the money. And again, for the same reasons I've described, that doesn't prevent anybody from spending money. It doesn't prevent anybody from speaking. It just gives us a kind of a truth in politicking sort of notion. We know who's behind it.
And so in a lot of ways, this is a fairly narrow decision in terms of that larger argument over campaign finance.
That is true. This doesn't in any way deal with the fundamental issues of the right of corporations to contribute money, expenditure limits, and contribution limits. This is on this sort of cul-de-sac in this area of the law dealing with disclosure rules.
Our thanks to Delaware Law Dean Rod Smola for taking time to join us this week on The Green. Next, the latest feature on the environment and climate change from our IC Change collaboration looks at declining moth populations in the First State and regionally. Stay with us. This is The Green on Delaware Public Media. You're listening to The Green on Delaware Public Media, and I'm Tom Byrne. Over the last 50 years, there's been reported declines of moths all over North America. And there's no simple answer for what's driving down their populations. Human development has led to deforestation and habitat loss. The spread of artificial light at night makes them easy for their predators to see. Changing climates are causing moth species and their natural enemies, like birds and bats, to expand or shift their geographical ranges. As one listener told IC Change, our project to answer your questions about changes you see in your environment, the sight of moths gathering around a backyard porch light is no longer as common as it used to be in Delaware. Delaware Public Media Science reporter Eli Chen went out to find out what's behind the dwindling moth populations in Delaware in our latest edition of IC Change.
One of the most vivid memories Jeff Gordon had growing up in Delaware was the sight of moths at night.
When I was just a kid in the mid to late 60s, my grandparents bought a place on Rehoboth Bay, and, you know, at that time, that was really out in the woods. And I just remember one of the most magical things as a kid in the evenings, there was, you know, we had a screen porch, and the lights there would attract just this carpet of moths, and not just tiny little brown moths. I mean, there were, you know, Luna moths and rosy maple moths and Prometheus and Polyphemus and, you know, just big, spectacular, intricately patterned and colorful moths. And it's really one of the things that I feel most strongly awaken an interest in nature in me. I think it just set me on a path that I've followed through the rest of my life.
Jeff Gordon is now the president of the American Birding Association, a national birdwatching organization that's headquartered in Delaware City. These days, he doesn't see as many moths as he used to when he was a kid.
It's just so radically different now, the numbers and the diversity. I mean, you know, I think most of those species are still present, but it used to be like a blizzard, and now it's a few flurries.
So here's what Gordon wants to know.
Do the observations of scientists, do they square with my own memories? Because my memories seem vivid and dramatic.
3 years ago, David Wagner, an ecology professor at University of Connecticut, published a paper on this very subject.
It's called Moth Decline in the Northeastern United States, and it actually addresses some of the same species that you're talking about.
Wagner notes that moths are already vulnerable animals. While typically only a single pair of moths are required to replace the previous generation, their mortality rates are incredibly high, greater than 95%. In Connecticut, where Wagner has studied moths for 25 years, many large moth species are in decline, and some have even extirpated or gone extinct in its local area. And among the people who feel the most are the local cocoon collectors.
If we call some of the old-timers up and talk to them about when they were a boy, they would go out with shopping bags and collect giant silk moth cocoons with their dad or their buddies and fill these up in half a day with mostly Promethea cocoons and Cecropia cocoons. And that phenomenon just does not occur at all in the East Coast anymore.
The reasons behind the decline of large moths on the East Coast are various and complex. From a distance, we can say human development has caused habitat loss, changing climates could create unsuitable conditions. But if you look at just one declining species, let's say the giant silk moth, the cause of its decline gets complicated if you look at the data as closely as David Wagner does. The rates of declining silk moth populations aren't consistent everywhere, and there are populations that appear to have plenty of silk moths.
So there's places in New Jersey that are still extremely good and seem to be intact. There are places, particularly in southeastern Ohio, that have just spectacular silk moth faunas. And then in the east, one place that's really important is Martha's Vineyard. Martha's Vineyard has a fantastic, seemingly intact fauna at the present time.
Wagner says the likely reason behind this has to do with what biologists call the natural enemy complex, which are basically the network of pathogens, predators, and parasites that can harm a species.
So there's something special about the natural enemy complex in New England at this point in time, or across the Northeast, or Delaware for that matter, that is challenging silk moths in a way they weren't challenged before.
And he definitely has some culprits in mind. Species that have been introduced by the government as a means of pest control, like the ladybug, could be feasting on moth eggs. There are also animals whose geographic ranges have changed because of climate or other factors, leading them to feed and deplete northeastern moths.
That tufted titmouse is a serious cocoon predator. And so they are very, very savvy predators, and they can devastate all the silk moth cocoons in a local area, but particularly Cecropia. And that's one of the species that's had the biggest collapse in our region. And that moved into our, it moved north from I would say, the south part of the United States into New England over the 1950s.
And in turn, scientists have also seen the decline of birds that were already feeding on moths in the area, songbirds among them. Artificial light is a major problem for moths. Wagner says there's no doubt they play a role in their decline. They get drawn to the headlights of cars that hit them. Lights make them easier for bats to see and prey on them. But it's not clear how much light has dragged down their numbers. And there hasn't been enough data to suggest that a lower density of artificial light in an area would help revive moth populations.
There's places like Martha's Vineyard in northern New Jersey where the moths are still intact. And I would think there'd be a fair amount of light pollution in those two areas.
Wagner says if we want to tease out what's really bringing down moth populations and why random places like Martha's Vineyard seem to be doing better than others, we need data, and lots of it, not just from scientists with PhDs.
This is a case where citizen scientists and people taking notes in their backyard and making observations in their backyard could generate the very data we need to sort of solve this conundrum.
There's enough data to suggest that something is happening to moths in the northeastern U.S., but it's not enough to pinpoint the exact causes, which leaves those like Jeff Gordon, who are wondering about the moths, without a precise answer.
It's scary sometimes to see these large-scale changes and ask, this is what we're seeing, what's going on that we might not be immediately seeing.
So whether it's a new predator or a change in climate, being able to explain what's happening to the moths might start with channeling that curious kid inside of us who wants to just sit out by that screen porch and admire the moths as they dance around the light. For Delaware Public Media and I See Change, I'm Eli Chen.
Thanks, Eli. This story is a part of I See Change, a national initiative to crowdsource and investigate the climate and environmental changes you see in your local communities. If you've got a question about something you're seeing in your backyard, or you want to show us the moths that you're seeing in your neck of the woods, post it right now at iseechange.org. Stay with us. There's more On the Green coming up, including our latest History Matters. But first, the latest news from Delaware Public Media. Welcome back to The Green. I'm Tom Byrne. In the 70s and 80s, Rehoboth Beach was a summer getaway for many gay men who worked in nearby cities and towns like Washington, D.C., Philadelphia, and even rural Pennsylvania. Some say that at the time, Rehoboth was one of the few places where they could truly be themselves. In the first of this month's two-part History Matters, our Ann Hoffman brings us an oral history of that community's roots in Rehoboth. In part two next week, we'll examine how that history served as the foundation for efforts to establish equal rights for the LGBT community in the first state. But in this week's piece, you'll hear the voices of Steve Elkins, Max Dick, and Bob Hoffer from Camp Rehoboth, which is celebrating its 25th anniversary this year. The camp in Camp Rehoboth stands for Create a More Positive Rehoboth.
It was pretty amazing. You would drive through on Route 50 and get to Annapolis. Oh my God, am I ever going to get there? And hit the Bay Bridge. And then the relief. It was almost as if it was a weather phenomenon that would take over. The relief that would come over your body and say, I'm on my way to the beach where I can be me.
It was like the highlight of our year. You know, we would go to Rehoboth a lot, and we'd also go to New York City a lot.
And we would drive into town, and all you wanted to do was unload the car, have a beer, and just say, thank God I'm here.
I was an elementary teacher for 35 years in a small town of Phillipsburg, and I had to be very careful about my sexuality. And I just felt more comfortable that I could really be myself down here.
We grew up in a time where you didn't just go around, especially starting in high school, like some of the kids are doing today, and coming out as gay. That was unheard of.
The gay area was south of what's now the we call Poodle Beach. We'd have to go across the Carpenter Beach, the DuPont area, into a no man's land, and that's where we all would pitch our chairs and have our time to sun and have a good time.
Used to be, of course, everybody had to have the obligatory rainbow umbrella and the rainbow towel, but that's starting to get passé now.
This would be our routine. We would go down there, stake out our place, sit down, and I would say to Max and our friends, I said, okay, where do you want to eat tonight? First, dinner. So we would decide, and then, this is way before cell phones, I would have to walk back up on the boardwalk, call and make a reservation, but that was always first priority. Then we knew how long we could stay on the beach and then go home, take our little nap, and go out for cocktails.
In the 70s especially was house parties. People whose neighbors just sort of winked and turned their head and gave a different eye toward what was going on next door. First year we had a madras party, which we painted the entire house. We had a fence in the back that with canvas with madras patterns that we did with a maze to get into it. Madras was the cocktail at the time, which was vodka and orange juice and cranberry, I think. The next year was an aquamarine and tangerine party where we repainted the house. It was the first year that I know of any house we had our own business cards printed up. We had our own t-shirts for the boys of 24 Christian Street. A lot of people have gone on to do that since, but I think we were probably the first people ever to do that, and that was in 1983.
We'd go out to the old Renegade,
which was a big dance club with an outside area. And that's where we'd go, and we'd dance till 2 or 3 in the morning.
It was like the place to go. And it wasn't just during the summer, but it was year-round. You would go out there. There was a cover charge, of course, but you just danced the night away.
Flashing lights, and then every once in a while the fog machine would come on, and then they would have boxes where people would get up on top of the box, and they'd be dancing.
It was a place to meet other guys. Whereas today, we have social media, we have Grindr, and people are always on their phone. They don't have to go out to, you know, find someone to go home with. Where back then, that's what a lot of people did. They went out to have fun and maybe find someone and take them home that night. I never remember being there that there were fights that broke out. I think everyone was just so happy to be there and have fun. Were there drugs going on? I'm sure there were.
Federal health officials consider it an epidemic, yet you rarely hear a thing about it. At first, it seemed to strike only one segment of the population. Now, Barry Peterson tells us, this is no longer the case.
I was looking at a photograph earlier. It's hanging in Lionel Murray's apartment. It's a photograph that from people that we shared a beach house with. That there were 9 of us in the photograph, and 4 of them are dead from HIV and AIDS.
Camp Rehoboth, every December the 1st, they have the AIDS Day, where they have a remembrance service. And we march down the street from the pavilion and end up at All Saints Church. And at that time, they read name after name after name of those who have passed away that either somebody down here knows or lived here or visited here. People are holding a battery candle, and whenever a name is read that they know, they'll raise it up in the air.
Starting in 94, 94, 95, 96, we had a funeral almost every weekend for somebody that was dying of AIDS. And I'm very fortunate that my husband Murray and I met in 1978, and it saved our lives. And to stand in a church and eulogize these friends was a turning point and pointed our lives where we said we have to do something. So Camp Rehoboth subsequently has one of the major contracts with the state of Delaware, the Division of Public Health, in educating people. And I think last year we gave away 70,000 condoms. It wasn't until the early 1990s when we finally said, we're going to put a face on this. No question there were a lot of gay people here before that. But in 1993, there was a horrendous gay bashing. There were four men from, mostly from, I think, Virginia Beach, and they had all been out on a Saturday night. It was about 1 o'clock in the morning. They were sitting, two standing on the south end of the boardwalk, when some young men from Lincoln, Delaware, came in town looking for a party. When they couldn't find the party, one of them said, "I got an idea, let's go to the south end of the boardwalk and beat up some faggots." One of them had the nylon sleeve, it had a Little League baseball bat in it, the aluminum baseball bat. He pulled it out and hit one of the gay men up beside the head. Another one had reached into a trash can and found a champagne bottle and hit another gay man upside the head. One of the men we thought would never be able to walk again. We had a chief of police at the time, Craig Doyle, who said, "We may not have hate crime legislation in Delaware, but this is a hate crime, and I'm going to approach it as if it is." Then Governor Carper, Tom Carper, who's now our U.S. Senator, stood on the steps or on the lawn of the police station in Rehoboth and signed hate crimes legislation that added sexual orientation, and he invited me to sit at the table. The community of Rehoboth said, "We're not going to take this anymore."
And it used to be we had to go to what would be, quote, a gay bar to feel comfortable. But now, I mean, like, one of our favorite places to go to in town now is the Purple Parrot, which gets a completely diverse crowd. And we've been there for some New Year's Eves where on the dance floor you have, same-sex couples, opposite-sex couples.
I don't think about it at all anymore. And, you know, I am who I am. And I have a loving husband. We've been together, as I said, for 35 years, got married in 2012. If we went back home right now and I saw an old friend, I'd say, "Oh, by the way, this is my husband." I'm at the, I guess, the point in my life now of being accepted to myself that if someone doesn't like it, that's fine. That's their opinion, and you don't have to be my friend.
Our thanks to Ann Hoffman for producing that piece, and Steve Elkins, Max Dick, and Bob Hoffer of Camp Rehoboth for providing their stories and insight. Again, we'll have the second half of this two-part History Matters next week when Kathy Carter looks at how this history served as the foundation for efforts to deliver equal rights to the LGBT community in the first state. Stay with us. The Green continues in a moment with our arts playlist, where we'll learn about an upcoming documentary on the Kalmar Nickel. This is Delaware Public Media. You're listening to The Green on Delaware Public Media, and I'm Tom Byrne. A documentary on the Kalmar Nickel begins filming this summer. The story of the Swedish colonial ship's transatlantic journey is being produced by a Pennsylvania-based production company in partnership with the Kalmar Nickel Foundation. Producers say the documentary will allow viewers to sail aboard the ship and recreate its harrowing journey. According to many scholars, the Kalmar Nickel's maiden voyage was one of the most ambitious and dangerous sailings in European history. And that, say producers, has all the makings of must-see TV. In this week's Arts Playlist, Delaware Public Media's Kathy Carter talks with the documentary's producer, Nancy Glass.
Nancy Glass, I understand that filming is actually going to get started real soon.
Yes, it is. We're very excited. We have lined up some fabulous people to talk about the history and this incredible, incredible forgotten voyage that established the first colony in the Delaware Valley. And so Sam Heed, who is the senior historian and director of education at the Kalmar Nickel Foundation, is sort of leading the way in finding some world-famous experts to talk about this. Pretty exciting.
And you're going to be filming in Delaware and actually in Sweden.
Yes. Well, the Kalmar Nickel was originally built, and I don't want to get this wrong, but it served the Swedish Navy as an auxiliary warship. So it was. It's very important to Swedish history as well.
Now, the Kalmar Nickel, of course, such a figure here in the state of Delaware. When did you first get involved with them approaching you to make this documentary?
Well, actually, I knew Sam Heat because I met him when he was a history teacher, and he was giving a lecture on Parents' Night, and when the bell rang, none of the parents left the room. They all wanted to stay and listen. And so when he left teaching and went on to the Kelmar Nickel Foundation, I started to read up on the Kelmar Nickel, and then we communicated, and he asked me, knowing that we've done documentaries, if we would be interested in doing this. And we are very interested. We're even their partners in terms of production. We are investing our own money in producing this because we believe this is such a great story.
What is it that makes it a great story? What are some of the elements that you find compelling?
Well, first of all, it's a forgotten journey. People don't remember this. They don't think about this, about our area and how important it was to the colonization of America. The fact that the Kelmar Nickel Foundation has built a new replica of it and the people can go out on that and have that experience makes it very important and very interesting. Just the story of the colonies, the story of the journey makes it all very interesting.
Now, you've been making documentaries for quite some time. Why don't you share with us some of the other productions that you've worked on? I know your company has produced programming for a bunch of the major cable networks.
Well, we do reality programming, but what we do is not the reality programming where people throw things at each other. We do a lot of very fun programming or adventure programming. We do a show on Travel Channel, which is an international adventure show. It's now called Uncommon Grounds. It was called Dangerous Grounds. We do Tanked, which is a big build show for Animal Planet. These two guys who built the world's largest fish tanks. And what I mean by that is they built a 75,000-gallon interior of a church, which they called the Fishtine Chapel. And then we did an award-winning documentary called Race to the Bottom of the Earth, which started out the same way, where I just heard a story and thought, this is going to be something very big. And we followed, a guy came into my office. Actually, a friend of mine called me and said, you have to meet my friend who's an explorer. And I said, what is he, eight? Who's an explorer? And he came in and he said, I am going to traverse the coldest, harshest, driest environment on Earth, Antarctica. I'm going to be the first American ever to do that. And I'm going to break a land speed record. And by the way, more people have landed on the moon than have done this. And when he got done describing that journey, I was in. And we made a documentary about his journey. We lost him halfway through, and it was very, very hairy and scary. And he shot the whole thing himself. We could not have any assistance, otherwise it would have jeopardized his record. But in the end, he did break a land speed record. He did become the first American. He broke his skis, so he had to walk. And by the time he reached the pole, his lungs were so badly frostbitten, the doctor said he would have been able to breathe for about another 24 hours.
Now, of course, this must be one of the things that makes a good documentary, something super compelling and interesting and different. So the Kelmar Nickel is something that you said that a lot of people don't, outside of Delaware, may not know about. How many people are going to be involved in making this documentary?
Probably be about 20.
Okay.
Listen, it's a compelling story, and you, Kathy, should know about compelling stories more than anyone, because it's harder on radio than it is on a film or television where I can rely on a picture. Storytelling, at its very basic, is about a very interesting core. And I think there's a very interesting core here.
When did you get involved in making documentaries, Nancy?
Well, I've been in television for 40 years.
Mm-hmm.
So when did I make documentaries? I have for a long time. But mostly what we do, documentaries are our labor of love. Mostly what we do is very commercial television. And of course we do phone apps and we do websites and we do all that very commercial stuff. This is what we do when we're in love with something.
You're based in Pennsylvania, not L.A.,
yes.
Not New York City.
No, we are based outside of Philadelphia, and very often the networks in L.A. or New York will say to me, what time is it where you are? And I want to say, it's 1982. You know, we all live in different parts of the country, but this just happens to be a fabulous place to live, and we're staying. I mean, we have 85 employees who are very happy to be here.
Now, of course, the filming is just beginning very shortly, and of course, you have to go to Sweden and do all of that work. When can viewers expect that they might be able to see this documentary on the Kalmar Nickel?
I'm not sure what the release date is. I think it's around December.
Okay, so that's actually a sooner turnaround than I anticipated you answering.
Yeah, we turn things around pretty quickly. I mean, people here are so experienced. And when we go out to tell a story, we know what the story is. We're just organizing it now. When you're talking about history, you know your story.
So there's a lot of pre-production then?
Yes.
Nancy, you mentioned you've been involved in making TV for 40 years. How has the medium changed?
Well, Kathy, it's changed tremendously. And it's a very good question because it changes constantly. Literally, not just decade by decade, but year by year, month by month, week by week. People are out there telling their own stories more than ever. When you can make a movie on an iPhone, you expect the story that you're told to be better, to be more intense, to be more engaging. And so that's how it's changed. We have to find new ways to engage people.
Our thanks to Kalmar Nickel documentary producer Nancy Glass of Nancy Glass Productions for her time this week. For more information on the Kalmar Nickel, you can visit kalmarnickel.org. And stick around. The Green continues in a moment with Enlighten Me and a trip to the Brandywine Zoo to learn how it helped its animals through the recent heat wave. You're listening to Delaware Public Media. Thanks for spending time with us on The Green this week. I'm Tom Byrne. Earlier this week, the First State suffered through its first heat wave of the year, facing temperatures in the mid-90s and heat indexes in the triple digits. Now, most people can handle the heat by staying hydrated and simply choosing to stay indoors where it's air-conditioned. And we often remind pet owners to keep their pets inside with water readily available and not leave them in cars. But handling the heat is a bit more complicated at Wilmington's Brandywine Zoo, home to animals from various climates, including some not accustomed to this sweltering weather. For this week's Enlighten Me, I visited the Brandywine Zoo to ask Zoo Director Gene Peacock how they help their animals beat the heat.
Obviously, you have a lot of animals from different climates, different habitats. Is it a major challenge to make sure that they're all safe and reasonably comfortable in heat like this?
And we have a combination. We have to look out for the animals and we have to look out for our public that comes to the zoo. But as far as the animals go, when we hit these extreme heat days, in particular, some of the animals are more acclimated to colder climates. We have to do a little bit of extra for those. So we do a number of things.
Are there a couple of animals in particular that need special attention?
For example, our red pandas. Red pandas generally come from the mountainous regions of China and Tibet, so it's generally a much cooler climate. So for our red pandas, they actually have in the back off exhibit where the public can't see it, they have their own air conditioner. So we'll turn the air conditioner on and it cools that whole back area for them. There's a mister in the exhibit because just misting the exhibit, you'll be amazed at how much that brings temperature down. And we also have a series of big fans in the top of the exhibit. So we do that for the pandas. Most of the animals, when it gets too hot, we'll give them access. They can go behind the scenes and they can get in the shade, and it's a lot cooler in some of the dens. So on these high heat days, we'll have access, and then some of them will have the misters and things like that.
You mentioned the public. I guess what do you have to do for the public, and does it make a difference for a public coming here when the animals have to kind of retreat sometimes to cool off?
You know, when the public comes, they do come in and they do expect to see animals. So we try to make sure when we have these high heat days, the front gate lets people know that due to the heat, some animals may have access. Our keepers and our education staff try to get out in the zoo and let people know what's going on. And then we'll do some creative things for the animals that the public can see and enjoy. We call it enrichment, and that's a daily part of the animals' lives. But when we get into the really, really high heat days, we'll do things like we'll make ice blocks with food treats frozen in them and give them to the animals. We'll dump piles of ice in the otter exhibit. I think they actually did that earlier today for the otters. Piles of ice with food scattered in it. We have misters and all kinds of different things we'll do to keep the animals cool, enrich their lives, and it also gives the public, you know, something to see. And then as far as the public goes, we just try to patrol the zoo more, keep an eye on people, make sure they don't get overheated, encourage them to stay hydrated, and our mister in the middle of the zoo is really, really popular on hot days like this with the kids.
This has been a summer that hasn't been particularly hot. This is the first major heat wave. Is it more challenging when it is more persistently hot? Or in some ways, you know, are you guys, you know, kind of like, you know, dealt out with snow removal? Do you kind of like build in your plans and build in your budget, having to deal with some of this, at least to a certain extent, every summer?
We deal with this so much that, you know, every summer gets hot. So we have a plan of action to deal with the heat for the animals, just like we have a plan of action for cold weather, for storms, and for any other thing that can happen. So we do plan for this. We have things we can put in place when the temperature hits a certain number. And all of our animals have actually a temperature guideline that the keepers go by. If it's below a certain temperature, we know the animal can't go out. If it's in a certain threshold, they may have access. And then when it gets too hot, we know when we need to turn on, you know, the misters and when we need to give them access. So we actually have very well planned out research guidelines as far as the animals go for that.
And it's something you also kind of plan for budgetarily as well. So you never get kind of caught with like, oh, we spent a whole lot of money trying to keep these animals cool and we weren't expecting that.
Right. We know it's coming in the summers. We know Delaware can get hot, not as hot as some places, but we know it can get hot. So we have, you know, resources for the ice. Our commissary manager, he plans ahead with things he'll need to, you know, to freeze and make icicles for the animals. We make sure all of our HVAC and our systems and all are in operating order. So we plan ahead for those things. And, you know, honestly, the heat is one of those. It almost seems like it takes more of a toll on the keepers than the animals, because the keepers have to be out here in it constantly and doing the work. And so we really try to look out for the people also.
You mentioned that there's also issues with storms and with cold. Is the heat more challenging or about the same as, you know, the opposite when it gets really cold and there's extreme cold or snow or even maybe a blizzard?
I would have to say, I think I'm from North Carolina, so I'm from the South. But I think the keepers and everybody would agree that the winters can be more challenging, because when it's hot, you're going to sweat and you can duck inside and get cool and you can go out and do something. But in the winters, especially like this past March, we'd have snow and then ice and then snow and then ice. And it just makes it hard to get around the zoo. We all pitch in and we have to shovel and clean up. And I know on days like this, we're going, wow, some of that might be nice. But I think the winters are a little more difficult with things freezing, having to clear the zoo of snow and all of that. The summers, it's you know, it can be tough, but I think it's a little easier to work in those conditions because we can get around, you can duck inside and cool off, and then you can come back out and work again a little later.
And finally, are there some animals here that actually are enjoying this, that are like, hey, I'd like to see more of this type of weather?
Oh, you'll see the condors right now are not doing it. I mean, when you get these warm, sunny days, the Andean condors in particular like to get out on the rocks and they'll spread their wings. They've got an amazing wingspan of about 8 to 9 feet. And they'll get out here where it's warm and they'll just sun their wings. And it's really beautiful to see them spread out like that. And earlier today, they had a sprinkler in the llama exhibit. And the llamas were actually running around playing in it. So they enjoy it. But, it, you know, in the middle of the day, it's just like when the people ask us where the animals are and the people are talking about how hot it is. It's hot for the animals, too. So the middle of the day from 12 o'clock to about 2 or 3 o'clock, they tend to kind of hunker down and get some shade. In the mornings, they're still pretty active, and right in the evenings when it's feeding time, they're pretty active.
Not all that different people.
Not that different for people.
And our thanks to the Brandywine Zoo's director, Gene Peacock, for enlightening us this week. And that's all we have time for On the Green this week. As always, the stories and interviews you've heard are online right now at DelawarePublic.org. Just head over to the Green's page on our website. And we have a new way for you to check out The Green. The show is now available via podcast at our website and on iTunes, so look for us that way as well. We also value your feedback and story ideas, so contact us via our Facebook page, on Twitter at TheGreenDE, or by emailing us at TheGreen@DelawarePublic.org. Thanks to all those who helped make today's show possible, Delaware Public Media's Kathy Carter, Eli Chen, Ann Hoffman, and Annie Ropeek, as well as our station manager, Casey Houts. For all of them and the rest of the staff here at Delaware Public Media, I'm Tom Byrne. Thanks so much for joining us, and we'll see you again next week on The Green, where Delaware explores its common ground.